From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Recovery teams have pulled 10 more bodies from the wreckage of the Champlain Towers in Surfside, Florida today. It is the biggest jump in death since the building collapsed nearly 2 weeks ago, and it brings the confirmed death toll to 46. 94 people are still missing. WLRN reporter Danny Rivero is with us now from Miami for the latest. Danny, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
And Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava spoke earlier. Let's listen.
Our commitment to this mission is deeply personal. This is our community, our neighbors, our families. And our first responders have truly searched that pile every single day since the collapse as if they're searching for their own loved ones.
Unfortunately, Danny, the death toll has been rising faster now in the last few days. What's the latest you're hearing about those efforts?
Right. So you mentioned the jump in confirmed deaths did jump pretty significantly overnight. We got 10 overnight, which is the highest jump we've had. And part of the reason that that jump happened, according to authorities, was because they, on the night of 4th of July at about 10:30 p.m., they demolished the rest of the standing building. And the reason they said they did that was because the looming safety concerns about the prospect that the remaining building could collapse and injure the search and rescue teams that were on the scene, it was hampering those efforts. So they brought it down with dynamite in a way that they say that it didn't affect the original rubble in any kind of way. They kind of blew it up in a way that went in the other direction. So they say only dust really fell into the original pile. But without that looming threat, they have been getting deeper into it and accelerating those efforts. And, you know, things are moving quicker now.
We're also hearing from officials today. They've updated the number of people who are still missing, but they've also said that they've not been able to confirm that all of those people were actually in the building when it fell. Can you explain what's going on with that?
Right. So the number of missing has never been a very concrete number. It's always been somewhat of an estimate. They're just being a little bit more explicit about that now because we have to keep in mind a building like this, there wasn't like a check-in system where the authorities at any time or that anyone ever knew exactly who was in the building. So they were just building off of information provided by family members. In some cases, there were family members who thought that their loved one might have been in the building that might not have turned out to be the case. So they're saying that there's 94 accounted for potentially. And there are, as the days go on, gathering more information from the families, learning new information, and updating that as needed. So it is a little bit of a fluid situation.
WLRN reporter Danny Rivero in Miami. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tropical storm Elsa has made landfall in the northwest part of Florida today. Let's bring in Megan Borowski. She's a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Megan, welcome to you.
Thank you, Peter.
And what were the conditions like this morning as the storm hit land?
So Elsa made landfall just before 11 o'clock this morning in Taylor County. So that's right where the Florida Peninsula meets the Panhandle. And we've just been dealing throughout the state with heavy rainfall, gusty winds at times, especially toward the Gulf Coast. We have had some tornado warnings up and down the peninsula. Nothing confirmed yet, but we have had tree damage and trees downed, especially in northern Florida. Also, just excessive rainfall, especially down toward the southwest portion of the state, where we had upwards of 13 inches of rain.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And yesterday, we know that rainfall and the lightning strikes that came along with the storm were causing some delays with the rescue efforts at the condo collapse. It does look like, however, that this storm is now on track to move north up the East Coast. What can we expect in the hours and in the days ahead?
Right. So it looks like Elsa is going to continue to push north-northeastward over the afternoon, impacting North Florida, the Jacksonville metro area. It should accelerate a little bit, so impacting Georgia and South Carolina tomorrow. And then the Mid-Atlantic, likely exiting off the New Jersey coastline on Friday. It could actually briefly re-strengthen into a tropical storm after becoming a depression later today. But really, heavy rainfall and gusty winds, the two main threats.
And just very briefly, what is the main concern at this point as it moves north? What's the prospect for flooding, for example?
Excessive rainfall and flash flooding, especially along the I-95 corridor, Peter.
All right. That is Megan Borowski, a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Thanks for your updates.
Thanks.
Let's go now to the Adirondacks of New York, which is in the middle of a housing crisis. The pandemic spurred the sale of second homes, and the short-term rental market is booming. That's left locals and seasonal workers with few affordable options. Emily Russell of North Country Public Radio reports from the tiny hamlet of Old Forge.
There's a little blue house right in the middle of town. It's got a grill out front and a wind chime hanging from a shade tree. That's where I meet Rick Kipp.
It's just a little three-bedroom bungalow, really.
Kipp is in his 30s. He's got a beard and long black hair. He lives here with his wife and their three kids. So it's a little on the small side, but they love the location. The kids can walk to school. Kipp can walk to work. He cleans and does maintenance on town buildings. In early May, there was a knock at the door. They were served papers that said their lease wasn't being renewed. They had 3 months to pack up.
We were panicked. It was very scary.
That's Kipp's wife, Samantha Moore. She, too, has long, dark hair and is about to have their fourth child.
I called everybody I've ever known my whole life, saying, like, please, like, you know, if you hear anything, let me know.
Moore and Kipp grew up in Old Forge. They've lived here all their lives. So their hope was to find a place to buy, to stay and raise their family here. They made an offer on a place back in early May. It was out of their budget and in rough shape, but Kipp says they were desperate.
They were asking for $230,000, and the whole inside of it needed to be remodeled and redone, and the bathroom floor was sagging.
Still, their offer was rejected. Kipp says it's frustrating that people like him, working multiple jobs, raising small kids, that there's nowhere for them to live.
We need more affordable housing here. It's not even a question. There's nowhere for anybody to live full-time without an extravagant amount of money.
From 2016 to 2020, home prices have shot up in Old Forge. Even ones that are not on the waterfront went up by 30%, according to local real estate data. At the same time, the short-term rental market, places like Airbnbs, skyrocketed. The town's tourism director, Mike Farmer, says that is pricing locals out and putting the local economy at risk.
Without affordable housing, we have no future for providing suitable living for the workforce.
The local water park built its own employee housing to fill one void. An affordable development was also built a few years back. But there's a lot more housing demand than there is supply. Bruce Mazarski says nearby Essex County has the same issue.
We have people eligible, we have money available, but no units for them to buy.
Mazarski heads the county's housing assistance program. They help people cover down payments and closing costs. They also offer rental assistance. Mazarski says the Adirondacks are at a turning point when it comes to housing.
Communities need to decide what their future is and how they want to respond to this. We're trying to help, but it's really the community's decision on how they want to move forward.
This housing crisis comes at a time when the Adirondacks are seeing another kind of crisis, the slow decline of school enrollments. Saranac Lake School District has shrunk by a third in the last two decades. The town of Webb, which includes Old Forge, is down 40% to just 250 kids in K-12. The district is about to lose a few more kids. After Rick Kipp and Samantha Moore's offer on the home in Old Forge was rejected, they got in the car and drove 30 minutes south. Moore says they went to see a home in the town of Forestport.
And it was a very nice house, and it was in our price range. But we said, that'll be the last resort. I doubt that's going to have to happen, but it did end up happening.
For the first time in her life, Moore and her family are leaving Old Forge. They're leaving the same school district they went to as kids. They have two children with special needs. Moore says she's worried about them starting at a new school. She's been telling the kids the move might not be forever.
Maybe someday down the road we can come back to Old Forge, but let's see how this works out. It helps that it's a really nice house and there's so much land. And we try and get them excited about, like, hey, we'll put a trampoline, we'll put a little playground in the back.
After being priced out of their hometown and forced to move out of their school district, Moore says they're lucky. They were saving for a down payment for months, so at least they could afford to move. A lot of people in the Adirondacks, she says, have it a lot worse. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Russell, reporting from Old Forge, New York.
As the nationwide debate over racism continues, we wanted to check in with someone tackling the issue in an unusual way, by making friends with members of the Ku Klux Klan. Daryl Davis is a black blues musician and author who has spent many years forming these relationships. Davis spoke with NPR in 2017 about how he got started with his work after he and a Klansman bonded over music in a bar.
The fact that a Klansman and a black person could sit down at the same table, enjoy the same music, that was a seed planted. So what do you do when you plant a seed? You nourish it.
Many have left the KKK after talking with Daryl Davis. They've even given him their white hooded robes and other memorabilia. So far, Davis has collected more than 200 items. Today, he's reflecting on the work ahead, during an historic moment when our country has come up against a pandemic, a racial reckoning, an election, an insurrection, and now a new president trying to pave a united path forward. Daryl Davis, welcome to Here and Now. How nice to have you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Well, after an historic year when we have seen protests and inflamed debates over racism, how are you feeling about the work that's ahead of you?
I am feeling extremely optimistic and hopeful. Look at the marches of last year, 2020, in the wake of the George Floyd lynching, if you will. What did the power structure see then? They saw an ocean of black people and an ocean of white people marching together. You know, we've never had that large a collective voice. Americans, white, black, whatever, working together for the common cause. And that, my friend, is the definition of the United States.
You say the pages of progress are turning faster.
Yes.
How would you gauge the state of white supremacy in America right now? Is it shifting in 2021?
What's happening is this. They are becoming very fearful. So what people in the KKK and neo-Nazis and alt-right, what they tell me is, Daryl, I don't want my grandkids to be brown. They call it the browning of America or white genocide through miscegenation, in other words, race mixing. And they're very concerned about their identity being erased. So this is why you're seeing all these upticks in recruitment for white supremacist groups, all these lone wolves, the insurrection at the Capitol. What did you see there predominantly? Mostly white people. These are the ones who are fearing that their identity is being erased. And it's a false perception. Nobody is going to take over and erase people out of this country. We all are Americans. We need to learn how to get along with each other.
And so I wonder what you were thinking on January 6th, the day the mob stormed the U.S. Capitol, because you base your approach on listening and understanding. So how did you make sense of what happened that day?
So I saw it coming. I was not in the least bit surprised. And this, you know, when you see somebody walking through the Capitol carrying the Confederate battle flag and somebody else wearing a Camp Auschwitz T-shirt, you don't have to ask what they're doing there or what they want. You know what they want.
Mr. Davis, you have memorabilia from white supremacists, from KKK members. You have their white hooded robes. Why do you keep these things? Why are they in your house? What do they represent to you?
They represent that those people no longer believe in what those items stood for. And, you know, people always ask me, well, Daryl, you know, why do you have that stuff? Why don't you burn it? Well, no, I'm not going to burn it. It is a part of American history. Racism, the KKK, is just as American as baseball, apple pie, and Chevrolet. It's a part of our history. We all have the good, the bad, the ugly, and the shameful in our history. and does not need to be destroyed. We need to learn from it. So I have a 501c3. I plan to open a museum one day, and that's where that stuff will be. Right now, I'm loaning a lot of it to the Orlando Holocaust Center for an exhibition they are putting on in the fall.
You've spent years going around the country talking to Klansmen in person to form relationships, to form friendships. And I'm curious how the pandemic has changed your efforts. I mean, were you trying to talk to KKK members on Zoom? How did that work?
Absolutely. Some of them actually do have Zoom. And yeah, I've talked to a lot of them on Zoom or through email or phone or telephone. I've met with some, you know, recently, you know, in person. You know, online is a tool. It's a double-edged sword, and depending upon how you use it, it can be used for the good or for the bad. And certainly, you know, we're seeing both. We're seeing a lot of cancel culture online. We're seeing a lot of recruitment online into a lot of these groups, extremist groups, etc. But it's also a means of connecting, you know, one another, and depending upon how you use it.
You have ongoing conversations and relationships with white supremacists, with KKK members. Do you ever worry about your safety?
Yes, and it's been imperiled from time to time. Fortunately for me, those times have been few and far between. But, you know, that's a risk, you know, you have to take. It goes with the territory. Somebody who is going to go so far as to join an organization that has a history of hating people so much that they string them up in a tree or drag them behind a pickup truck or bomb their churches and things like that. Yeah, you know, you will face some of those people who believe in that, and I have. But there are others who, even people like that who have that mentality, if they are willing to sit down and have a conversation with you, there is at least an opportunity to plant a seed or offer a better perspective or perception, and hopefully they will resonate with it. But the key is, once you plant that seed, you must return and nourish it, water it, in order for it to bloom.
Hmm. Can you share with us one conversation that stands out in your mind from all the rest?
Sure. There are a lot of them, but I'll give you an example of something. And this is kind of amusing, actually. This guy was called an exalted cyclops in the Klan. That means a district leader. He was in my car with me one day. We're riding around, and he got on the topic of black people and crime. And he said something that I'd heard before from other Klan people, that all black people have a gene that makes us violent, because, you know, that's what's brainwashed into them. And I said to him, you know, what do you mean? And he said, well, who's doing all the drive-bys and carjackings in Southeast? He was referring to Southeast Washington, D.C., which is predominantly black. There's some white people who live there, but it's predominantly black and very high crime-ridden. And I said, okay, it's black people. I said, but that's what lives there. You know, you're not considering the demographics. Who's doing all the crime up in Bangor, Maine? You know, white people, because that's what lives there. He says, no. The demographics have nothing to do with it. You know, you all are born with this gene. So he's over in my passenger seat. I'm driving in the driver's seat. I look over at him and I said, listen, I'm as black as anybody you've ever seen. I have never done a carjacking or a drive-by. How do you explain that? He didn't even think about it for a second. He answered me, boom, like that. He said, your gene is latent. It hasn't come out yet. So I thought about it. And I said, you know, we all know that all white people have a gene within them that makes them a serial killer. And he says, well, how do you figure? And I said, name me three black serial killers. He couldn't do it. I said, they're all white. And I said, son, you are a serial killer. He said, Daryl, I've never killed anybody. I said, your gene is latent, hasn't come out yet. He goes, well, that's stupid. I said, you're right, it is stupid. But it's no more stupid for me to say that about you than what you said about me. And he got very, very quiet for a moment or two, and then he changed the subject. Within 5 months, he quit the Klan based on that conversation alone. And his robe was the first one I ever got. This was some years ago.
What could someone be doing today to help bridge the divide
that we have in this country, even in small ways. Maybe they're not ready to go as far as meeting with a KKK member like you do, but they want to help build relationships with people who think very differently than they do. What do you recommend, Mr. Davis?
Sure. What I advise people to do is walk across the cafeteria and sit with somebody new who is not a member of your table group. You will learn something from them, you will teach them something about you, and you will gain a new friend. And it's, you know, as far as going to Klan rallies or neo-Nazi rallies, you know, if that's not your thing, if you're not comfortable with that, don't do it. You know, nothing says you have to do that. You have to be on the front line. You can be on the back line. You can be on the sideline. You can be online, but be doing something, even if you consider it to be minute, that supports those people on the front line that are bringing far right and far left people together to have these conversations and plant these different perceptions in their minds. Because one's perception is one's reality, and nothing gets resolved without conversation. A missed opportunity for dialogue is a missed opportunity for conflict resolution. So you can support those people working on the front lines, offer them encouragement, you know, provide them with support from that end. You don't have to be on the front line.
A missed opportunity for dialogue is a missed opportunity for conflict resolution.
Yes, ma'am.
Darryl Davis is a black blues musician and author who has spent years forming relationships with members of the Ku Klux Klan. His conversations have helped more than 200 white supremacists leave the group. Darryl Davis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Clayson. I really appreciate you having me.
Capitalism touches every part of our lives.
Capitalism is a giant force that I don't understand.
I feel that it's a very safe system.
I'm constantly in fear of losing my job.
It is our biggest success and our biggest failure.
On this special series from Throughline, Capitalism.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
The Biden administration is working on some new protections for airline passengers. Among the proposals from the Department of Transportation is a change that could make it easier for you to get refunds when you don't get a service that you paid for. Here and now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan joins us now. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Peter.
And first of all, what is the problem that the Department of Transportation is trying to solve?
Well, last year, there was a surge, Peter, in complaints about airlines. And that came after several years of some airlines actually doing better compared to what had been a historically poor reputation. But yeah, last year, 102,000 complaints, up from 15,000 a year earlier. And 87% of those complaints, Peter, were about refunds. You can imagine why. During the pandemic, people were trying to get their money back for flights that they weren't able to take. But just overall, people unhappy with airlines, even though they weren't flying.
Tell me what kind of refunds we're talking about here. Is it just for canceled flights or is it something else?
Well, it can be, but it's other things too. And this, as first reported by Politico, Peter, legislators want to do something about, you know, what happens if you pay for a checked bag and the bag doesn't show up, or all of those other optional fees, which are relatively unregulated, right? Speedy boarding, let's say, right? And then what if you don't get to board first? Not really regulations about those right now. And that's the kinds of things that we're talking about here, which have gone on for years, but sort of come to the forefront now because of everything that happened last year. People paying fees for trips in some cases they didn't take.
Yeah, I see that the Department of Transportation is also looking to change how airlines actually inform customers about baggage and cancellation fees. What's that about?
Right. So this would standardize all of that. And there are some airlines, Peter, that are already doing something like what the department is proposing. But again, right now, just kind of voluntary. Delta and Alaska Airlines, for example, are two that already provide some kind of compensation if your bag isn't there within a certain amount of time. You know, your flight comes in and more than 20 minutes later, your bag's not on the carousel, you're going to get something back. But right now, that's just sort of an airline by airline thing. And they want to see more of that and standardization in terms of those alerts.
I see from the Transportation Department that baggage and change and cancellation fees, they add up to nearly nearly $9 billion, and that's in 2019. So what kind of impact might this have on the airline's bottom line?
Yeah, they're called ancillary fees, but the word kind of a misnomer when you see a figure like that, obviously a core part of the revenue right now. Well, it's not that they're planning to eliminate these fees, but airlines would have to really show people that, you know, you're getting what you pay for in terms of the speedy boarding, the bag or what have you. So if they can't get it right, then that revenue, at least some of it, would be at risk.
Yeah. Just briefly, Seth, tell me, how did the 4th of July weekend holiday travel go? I hear it was kind of tough out there.
Yeah, it was. And part of that's because of airlines that had sort of ramped up their ambitions to carry people faster than they were actually able to do at American Airlines. A lot of cancellations, Southwest too, some cancellations. It was a busy weekend, the busiest of the pandemic era, at least at the airport still. Down about 20% compared to 2019, the last normal year. But on the roads, Peter, the firm Arrivalist, which tracks GPS data, says it was fully back to 2019 levels.
Oh, wow. That's good news and bad news, I guess. Here and now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, thanks very much.
Thank you, Peter.
This September, Americans will mark the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks that killed nearly 3,000 people in New York, Washington, D.C., and Pennsylvania. Well, now, thousands of family members of those victims are pressuring the courts to release information they say proves Saudi Arabia had a role in the attacks, a contention Saudi Arabia denies. The most damning information, the families say, is a series of recent video interviews with three Saudi men. So why is that information sealed? Let's bring in Brett Eagleson. He was 15 years old when his father was killed in the attack on the Twin Towers. He's a plaintiff in the lawsuit. Brett, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Also joining me is Jim Kreindler. He's co-chair of the Plaintiffs Committee representing families in the 9/11 terrorism litigation. Jim, nice to have you as well.
Nice to be here, Jane.
So let's start with you, Jim. You are representing the plaintiffs in this lawsuit. This is a group of about 10,000 family members who want Saudi Arabia to be held accountable for the 9/11 attacks. Tell us briefly about this lawsuit.
Sure. Finally, after nearly 20 years, we have gotten to the bottom of the story. And what we know as a fact is a group of Saudi officials, government officials, spent nearly 3 years helping al-Qaeda prepare for and launch the attacks. These Saudi officials located the spots in California, where the two lead terrorists would arrive, be housed, given money to enable them to murder 3,000 people on 9/11. Unfortunately, we've been fighting not only Saudi Arabia, but the United States government, who has continually kept key documents locked up. The documents that we have been given, we cannot show Brett and the other family members because of the gag order that was imposed on us.
So I understand the gag order, but what is the motivation of the U.S. government for keeping these documents under wrap?
Sure. It is the colossal intelligence failure and law enforcement failure for years. Instead of having the FBI immediately arrest known dangerous al-Qaeda terrorists, they were watching them. For a year and a half, they were under surveillance in the United States. We believe that there are more specific misdeeds that some people in the government are tremendously embarrassed about. But I can't talk about those because of the gag order.
Jim, I need to push back a little bit. I mean, the U.S. government says there's a gag order for a reason, that there are national security issues here. It's more complex than that.
It isn't. And it's not true. The gag order was imposed on us to protect the privacy interests of witnesses, the witnesses being people who are complicit in mass murder. And let me give you an example. Right after we started this suit, We served a Freedom of Information request, and our request was denied. We would have to get a statement from Osama bin Laden authorizing the release so as not to interfere with his privacy interests. So for our government to invoke the privacy interests of people who should be indicted for mass murder has absolutely nothing to do with national security and everything to do with covering up their own embarrassment and failures.
So tell us about these depositions. The U.S. government has never said that there was actual proof to link Saudi Arabia to 9/11, but you think these depositions will change that. Tell us why.
The depositions have changed that. There's no question about it. You know, apart from the lies and contradicting each other, the essential facts are now known. The Saudi government knew who they were, deliberately helped them, and our intelligence agencies knew it as well.
And Jim, I'd just like to jump in here for a sec. I challenge any listener today to go out and find the Saudis giving some kind of explanation as to the information and documents and evidence we have. And the only thing you'll ever find in the media is that the 9/11 Commission report found that there were no senior level officials of Saudi Arabia involved. But the commission ended in 2004. The FBI investigated it for another dozen years, and all the way up until 2016 with Operation Encore. And those FBI agents are the real heroes that pursued all the leads that the 9/11 Commission never did. So where our lawsuit picks up is where our government stopped and failed us. So we're doing the work that our government should have done.
Brett, you were 15 when your dad died. You said in May that these depositions are the most important of them all. That's your quote. Why is this so important to you?
This is the first time that these individuals had to answer for any involvement in 9/11. And if you look at the evidence and the trail of documents that our team has put together, all roads point back to Saudi Arabia. And these three government officials, Fayyad al-Thumairi, Omar el-Bayoumi, and Mossad al-Jarrah, are senior level officials. They're working from the Saudi embassy in the United States in Washington, D.C. You have a guy by the name of Mossad al-Jarrah who works in the Washington, D.C. embassy. He's having hundreds of phone calls to radical Saudi government officials, and those two officials are the ones that are coordinating all the efforts and on directing all the assistance to the handlers and to the hijackers themselves. And the fact that these three individuals have never been held accountable, to me, is just mind-boggling.
I know you've been so optimistic, Brett, about bringing justice here, but the depositions happened and they came and went, and you still really don't know what was in them. What are you hoping they'll reveal?
Well, first of all, I want the world to know what's happening to us. If this was a normal murder case where my father was gunned down in the streets of New York City, I could walk into the police department and meet with the detective and read about all the information that the New York City Police Department has on the murder of my father. But because this was a mass terror attack, somehow that makes it so that the family members can't know anything about it. It feels like we're being stabbed in the back by our own government. We loved our country, and we did everything our government ever asked of us to do. And here we are 20 years later, and our government failed us 20 years ago, and they're continuing to fail us today by keeping this information from us. The most troubling thing to me is that our government says, oh, yes, we have thousands of pages of documents, we have thousands of pages of evidence, but we can't give it to you because it's a state secret.
Jim, I hear, we all hear the pain in Brett's voice. And I wonder, given the facts here, as you know them, would you go as far as to call this a cover-up of the U.S. government?
Absolutely. It is the worst cover-up I am aware of in our nation's history. Because the government has released some information selectively. A lot of what the government has released creates a completely false narrative. They've released bits of information that might exculpate certain Saudi government officials when we know there is a whole body of evidence that will inculpate the officials. So for the government to release a tidbit that the Saudis like and hold back a mountain of evidence that we know will show the world the truth about what those officials did. People in our government are quite literally helping Saudi government officials get away with murder for 20 years.
Brett, I want to end by asking you how you're doing. Does this fight that you're engaged in make it easier for you to cope as we come up on the 20th anniversary of these attacks, or is it harder?
It makes me feel proud that I can do this work on behalf of the 9/11 community and do it in the name of my dad. I think he would be really proud. But it also makes it really hard to realize what our government has done to us. And, you know, I am a patriotic person. I love this country. But it's a hard issue to come to terms with, to know that your country doesn't love you back the way that you love your country. I have a brother that served in the military. He did the call and he went to Iraq 2 times. It's just a hard thing to come to terms with, that your government doesn't respect you, your government won't cooperate with you.
We've been speaking to Brett Eagleson, one of the thousands of family members of 9/11 victims, asking that depositions and documents about Saudi Arabia's possible involvement in the attacks be unsealed, and Jim Kreindler. He's co-chair of the plaintiff's committee representing families in the 9/11 lawsuit against Saudi Arabia. Jim and Brett, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you for having us.
Last night, an electrifying start to the NBA Finals in Phoenix, Arizona.
Paul will dribble it out. First Finals game in 28 years, and the Suns give their fans a magnificent performance.
The Phoenix Suns kicked off the series with a win against the Milwaukee Bucks. More than 16,000 fans packed into the arena in scorching hot downtown Phoenix to watch two teams that haven't been to the NBA Finals in decades. Let's bring in A. Sherrod Blakely. He's NBA contributor for the Bleacher Report. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
I'm glad to have you here. So the Phoenix Suns get ahead of the Bucks early in this series. What were your takeaways from game one?
Well, the biggest takeaway is what we've been, frankly, taken away from the Suns all season, and that is the CP3 effect. You know, the guy that is known as the point god, which is a great nickname, by the way, one of the better nicknames out there. He's living up to the billing in this moment. When you look at 32 points, 9 assists in that game one win, we haven't seen anyone do that type of damage at that age since Michael Jordan. And whenever you are doing anything that is putting you in the same conversation with Michael Jordan and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Steve Nash, some of the all-time greats to have played the game, it speaks to how special your play is, and maybe most important, how you have, frankly, again, maximized this moment.
Well, on the other side, last night, less than an hour before tip-off, we found out that the Bucks superstar Giannis Antetokounmpo would play in game one after he'd been sidelined with a knee injury for several games. And here's how Suns fans welcomed him every time he tried to make a free throw. They're counting there. They're taunting him for how long it takes him to make a free throw. Giannis did end up with 20 points, 17 rebounds. What kind of impact did the Bucks star have on this game? And did he look fully healthy to you?
I love the fact that fans are pretty consistent in their countdown with Giannis, I even pulled out the stopwatch to do it myself. And there were a couple of times where he really hit that 10-second mark a little bit on the north side of that.
And that's the rule. But you got to get it out by 10 seconds, right? Yeah.
Exactly. But as far as how he looked, I thought he looked surprisingly better than I thought he would. For me, it wasn't so much the amount of points or shots he was taking, but how he was looking to score. He was looking to use his power, looking to attack the rim, the types of things that he has done historically in his career. For him, the biggest challenge is just going to be fatigue, getting back in basketball shape. One of the oldest adages that players will tell you all the time is that there's conditioning, there's shape, and then there's basketball conditioning shape. But certainly, when you're looking at an injury that many thought might cost him an entire year, even he alluded to that, the fact that he only missed a couple of games and he came back with a 20-17 4-assist game. If you're Milwaukee, you're thinking he's only going to get better as this series goes on. And that is, for them, that's the silver lining out of game one.
Well, he's got to be motivated to play in the finals because it has been so long since either of these teams have been this far. The Suns last made it in 1993. They lost to the Chicago Bulls. I remember that series really well. The Bucks haven't been this far since 1974, and only one player, Jay Crowder, on the Suns has ever played in the finals at all. Well, what's the road been like for these two teams to get this far?
Well, the one thing that I think both teams feel good about is that the road has not been paved with gold. When you look at Milwaukee, we just talked about Giannis Antetokounmpo and the injury that sidelined him for a couple of games. I think it was telling that they were able to close the series out, the previous one against the Atlanta Hawks, without their best player. And on the flip side, you look at Phoenix, you know, they had a couple of games where they did not have Chris Paul, who has been their North Star. The way this team goes, he is the one that's leading that direction. And for them to win a couple of games without him says a lot about what they are as a unit and not so much the individual. That gives them the confidence that even when adversity strikes within a game, they can figure out a way to get back in and potentially win.
Well, you know what else we noticed? There's some great players in this series, absolutely, no doubt, but there is no LeBron James. There is no Steph Curry, no Kevin Durant, none of these iconic NBA superstars. How do you think that fans outside of Phoenix and Milwaukee will be responding to this series?
That, unfortunately, is a question that the NBA, gosh, they wish we didn't have to ask or answer that question. But it's real. One of the strengths of the NBA Finals historically is the ability it has had to bring in the casual fan. And the casual fan is the one that knows about LeBron, but maybe never saw him play or saw him play sparingly. You're not going to get a lot of people who are going to know about Chris Paul. They're more familiar with him from his State Farm commercials than they are about the way he played in NBA games. But at the end of the day, the NBA, it's been a rough season when you look at the pandemic and things of that nature. They're just trying to figure out a way to get through this season, get a champion crowned. And fortunately for them, it's going to be a new look champion, which creates a whole other set of storylines going forward.
Game two, Thursday here in Phoenix. What do you think? Suns in four, right? I mean, that's what I'm thinking.
I think the Suns will win. I think the Suns will win game two. I think this series will go at most six games. Would not be surprised if it goes five. To me, the key is going to be Giannis Antetokounmpo's ability to steadily improve as the series goes on. And for Phoenix, you know, I can't believe that Chris Paul will be able to play like this consistently. So I think there will be a little bit of a kind of falling back to earth moment for them. But I still think the Suns will win this in six.
A. Sherrod Blakely, NBA contributor for the Bleacher Report. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. Go Suns!
Aha, the Giannis countdown. I love it. I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. It's Here and Now.